The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands and millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day two of this five-day session here at Hidden Valley Zen Center in Southern California. And I'd like to speak a little bit about why we come to Zen, and a little bit more than that too. Everyone is born. We're born into a family that we have an affinity with, karmically. It may be a positive affinity, it may be a negative affinity, but it is an affinity. And as we grow, we receive interactions from our caregivers, from our parents or other caregivers, and they bring forth in us, these interactions bring forth in us a perspective of the world, of the universe. Is it safe? Is it happy? Do I feel nurtured? Is it a positive experience living, or is it a negative experience living? And this conditioning begins to accumulate, and through this conditioning we begin to get a self-image, a picture of who we think we are based on our assumptions around how we're treated, people's reactions to us, and so on and so forth. And if it's a positive self-image, that's one thing. If it's a negative self-image, which for many people there is a subtlety, a subtle aspect of negativity in our self-image. Perhaps because we are brought up in ways where we are chastised for doing things people don't think we should do. And the chastising happens to take place in a way that makes us believe that there's something wrong with us, as compared to something wrong with our behavior. It's not at all helpful to say to somebody, you're just stupid, or you really did one that time. If you need to comment on somebody's behavior, it's important in the grand scheme of things to comment in a way that you're speaking to the behavior and not the person. Because in Buddhism we believe very firmly that everyone, all beings, are perfect, whole, and complete. But because of all this conditioning, we don't recognize that, and so we act out of the conditioning. And that creates problems. It also creates problems for us as we grow up, because we begin to get a negative self-image, and we're reacting out of that negative self-image. We feel insecure. It is troublesome. We get embarrassed easily. We feel less than in many, many circumstances. And this is only because of the self-image. It's only because we've drawn conclusions by our experiences of how we were interacted with or reacted to by the people around us as we were growing up. And this is how people learn. There's an important component in this. It's rather interesting that there's a woman named Brené Brown who's been doing a lot of research, decades literally of research, into the subject of shame. One of the things she found out was that nobody will claim it. Nobody says they feel shame. They may say they feel embarrassed sometimes, but they never will say they feel shame. So there's something shameful about feeling shame. And yet she feels that universally everyone has that, simply because of the child rearing techniques that I've just described. She also feels that the potency of shame, which is quite potent, which is why shunning is so painful, a punishment, when people won't have anything to do with you. It's extremely painful. She feels that it's virtually bred into our DNA to want to belong, to need to belong, to need to be accepted, to need to be part of a greater whole. And this is the fundamental basis for our Zen practice, really. Because in Zen, we teach that we aren't limited to this body, this person that we think we are. In fact, we're not limited at all to that. That is generally considered something of an illusion. But that we are not only part of a greater whole, but we are the greater whole. The famous Zen master, Dogen, Japanese Zen master, lived in the 12th century, said, to study the way, meaning to study practice, to do practice, to study Zen, is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Let go the self-image. To forget the self is to become enlightened by the 10,000 things. And to become enlightened by the 10,000 things is to remove the barrier between self and other. And I'd add, realize that there really are no barriers. That we are the universe. Or as Kapla Roshi used to say, we are the universe in fee simple. He was an old businessman of the old-fashioned sort. And when we go deeply enough in our practice, we feel that interconnection, that being part of the flow of life, not a separate thing part of the flow of life. It's not like we're a log floating down the river with other logs. We are the river flowing. As we grow up, depending on our self-image, we are sometimes drawn to find what it is beyond. There's some sense, perhaps, that there's something beyond ourselves that we can open to that is really important to reconnect with, to open to. It's a deep longing for connection of a profound level. So people fall in love, get married or partner up, and so often the marriages fail, the relationships fail. And people go on to try another one. In the honeymoon period, when we have really let go our expectations of what the other person is, and we're willing to be open and accepting, it can be an amazing relationship. But sooner or later, that honeymoon period ends because of our conditioning, and all of a sudden, we really don't like the fact that the toothpaste tube is squished in the middle where we should feel it's more appropriately rolled up from the end, and things like that. Little things start grabbing us. It all points to a deeper, more fundamental search for reconnection, true reconnection. And some people, unfortunately, will go through their lives attempting again and again through what society says will make them happy and never getting there. Elizabeth Taylor was famous for how many marriages she had. I think it ended up being 8. What is it that we chase after? Thinking it will bring us peace, happiness. Let me tell you about a woman that I knew. She lived up in Santa Barbara. She died in her 70s. And when she was a college student, actually before that, let's go back to when she was a teenager. She was a teenager. She used to collect aphorisms. Some of you have known this story. And she had a scrapbook with aphorism pasted in. And every time something happened, some event happened, she would run to her scrapbook and look up the aphorism that fit the event. And she was puzzled to see that every time the event had passed, the aphorism no longer fit the circumstance that came next. And so she began to wonder if there wasn't some underlying deep truth that always was true. And that set something in motion for her. And by the time she got to the University of Michigan as a freshman, it became quite a quest. She was raised Catholic, so she went to visit her local parish priest, who was apparently a young and engaging man who was very popular with the college crowd. And he gave her a stack of books on dogma to read, which she dutifully did, but realized that her answer did not lie there. She took courses in psychology, philosophy, other things as near as she could figure out were related to her quest. Still, she couldn't find her answers. But gradually, the search went deeper and deeper and deeper. And by the time she was in her second year of college, where by that time she was a scholarship student because the market crash had happened in between and her father's fortune had fallen to naught. And so she was living in a family house, taking care of the kids and doing some light housework to get room and board as she was going to continue her education at the University of Michigan. And she said that it took her hours to do just a few things of ironing. Back then we had to iron everything. And it was because she would start to iron and the question would just grab her. What is this deep truth? Is there a deep truth underlying everything that's always true? And if there is, what is it? And she searched more and more deeply. She began to get drawn in to the quest more and more completely. And in fact, she was sitting in a class in a front row seat in front of a visiting lecturer from England, I think it was. And she had some insight suddenly, and it caused her to gasp and get a surprised look on her face. And she apparently impacted the visiting Englishman to the point where he stopped his lecture cold to ask her if there was something wrong with her. So it went on like that. And eventually, she went home on, I think it was Thanksgiving vacation one year. And by then she decided to major in psychology and go all the way to a PhD, but she was still, I believe she was still undergrad. She went home, she's sitting on the edge of her bed in her room. She glances over at her desk in the corner and she wrote, "The world changed onyx axis. And from then on, nothing was the same for her anymore. She had a profound awakening experience that 20 years later was still alive for her, despite the fact she had no way to continue to deepen it. She had no guidance. She had not ever heard of Buddhism, much less Zen. Back there in the 30s, it just wasn't really known too much, if at all. And it wasn't until she got married and moved to California that she encountered some Zen folks who were not exactly practicing. They were doing more talking. And suddenly she realized that this experience of enlightenment that they talked about was one that that was what had happened to her. She had refused to talk about it after a few attempts because nobody clearly understood. And she vowed never to speak of it again until she found somebody who would. And eventually she found her way to Mayazumi. He was sensei then, and went through the entire koan curriculum with him, practiced with him throughout his teaching life. And he actually asked her to start teaching after she finished her work, and she declined. And when I met her, and I met her because she was asked to write about this experience she had had when she met Yasutani Roshi up in Northern California. And he said that he was sure that she had had a true awakening experience, and that he didn't feel the need to test her because it was so clearly still alive for her. She was so clearly still living out of that same truth that she had uncovered. And when I met her, she was a remarkable, wonderful, bright, humble, fascinating woman. Quite alive, interested in life. She and her husband had divorced, but they were calling each other every day just to make sure they were alive. And actually, her husband predeceased her, and she had a grown son by the time I met her. But it was clear that this experience she had had, opening to a dimension of reality that we all have within us, but which we cover up unwittingly with our conditioning. And it was still functioning for her, that inner dimension of freedom. Flora Courtois she was just a college kid. And yet, she had this profound awakening. Nothing special, she just persisted in her practice. She wouldn't even have called it Zen practice back then because there was no term that she understood. But she persisted in her questioning. And this is very important for our practice. We have to persist in the practice. We can't start and stop. We can't go forward and start to go deep. And then often what will happen for people is there will be some sense of resistance come up or some sense of fear come up, and we'll back off. We'll find something else much more interesting to do for the time being. And then at some point, the need to practice will return to us and we'll start again. But if it just doesn't work to do it that way, because we go back almost to zero. And you think about any kind of skill that you're practicing, playing the piano, archery, even riding a bicycle, for example. If you start to ride the bicycle, to learn how to ride the bicycle, and then you quit before you've really learned to ride it, and then you kind of almost have to start all over again. And it is that way with practice too, but there is some kind of sense within us that if we let go, and we're asked to let go through the practice, to let go of the self-image, it feels dangerous, it feels threatening, it feels quite scary. And that is often what will stop people. There's another aspect to it, and that is that if we've had a traumatic life, we've managed to function pretty well despite it. And we've managed to function pretty well despite it by suppressing the history, the experience. And as we continue to do our Zazen, we begin to open up to deeper things within us. Deeper conditioning, deeper experiences. And these things can come up. It's a tremendously fertile time to find a qualified therapist and begin to work through these things, because otherwise they'll hold us by the neck throughout the rest of our life, driving us beneath the radar. So it's a challenging thing to do Zen practice. But if we persist, it is incredibly worth it. This sense that we have that there is something beyond our normal cognition, beyond our normal awareness, that is deep and true and fulfilling and free, and that we can open to, that in a way belongs to us, really, except there's no us for it to belong to, but that's a whole different subject. That's real, and we can reach that. Countless men and women for centuries have done this hard work and gotten there. And it is the same for each one of us here. All we have to do is persist. And you've got a couple of good teachers to help guide you. They've been there, done that before you. And you've got this wonderful Zendo. You've got this fantastic Sangha, supportive, really great people. It couldn't be better, really. So you've got the real support system. So if things start getting challenging or difficult, go to one of the senior people. Talk about it. See how they managed to get through it. Because most likely they did have something like that come up. And you can receive some pretty important information, some pretty fine help. Flora's not the only person that had such an experience. There are many people who had what's called spontaneous awakening, and there's many, 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 many more who had awakening experiences within the context of a spiritual practice. Not necessarily even a Zen practice. You have the Christian mystics, John of the Cross, Meister Eckhart, Julian of Norwich, and other unnamed people going far back in history. Because there really is something deeper, more fulfilling that you can open to. And if you open to it deeply enough, You will be filled with joy because it's incredible freedom from this conditioning. And it doesn't mean, you know, when we say freedom from conditioning, conditioning has its role. We're conditioned to behave the way society says is the right way to behave so that we can belong, but also so that we can be safe, so that we can fit in and live relatively happily, so we can be accepted. And at the base level, if you have a near miss, if you start to run across the street and suddenly a car comes out of nowhere and you sprint and you get out of the way fast enough, next time you go across the street, you're going to be a little bit more careful. It helps to keep us alive. But the downside of it is sometimes society's ways are not positive. Sometimes they're not embracing. Sometimes they're not fulfilling. Sometimes instead they can be damaging. But when we open to this deep understanding within ourselves, we experience the most tremendous freedom that can go along with society's values. But when society's values are not appropriate, there is also the freedom to move in a more appropriate direction. It's not license. It's not like the 50s beat poets who sort of felt like if they did Zen, it was let it all hang out. Behave however you want to. It's okay, I'm doing Zen. That's not what Zen is about. Because there's an inner gyroscope, I guess I'd call it, an inner sense of ethical behavior within each of us. And the freedom that comes up is also freedom to experience that fully. So that there's almost like an inner sense of what's right to do next, what's appropriate to do next. We're not really in danger of running naked into the street because we have no conditioning anymore, or I should say we've seen through the conditioning, we still have the conditioning. So not to worry about that, but take advantage of this beautiful place, this wonderful environment, and dive deeply within yourself. The tool is there. This extended out breath is truly a fast track to opening up and becoming more free. And that freedom includes opening up to our innate wisdom and compassion so that that can come to life more completely with less inhibition from conditioning. That's what practice is about. We do it for the long haul if we want results. I think that's about all to say. I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.